welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. We were set up in 2002 and it goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, Maurice Kirk's in again in his ongoing case in Cardiff, which is set to make legal history. So we start with Maurice. Maurice, how are you getting on?
Well, I'm rather tired.
just remind listeners of your case. How long has this been going on, this particular one?
Well, this is me against the Chief Constable of the South Wales Police. And I employed Bristol solicitors actually 20 years ago this month. Because I was getting harassed by the South Wales Police generally on the road, mainly traffic matters. But I've just about finished a three-month trial in Bristol, in Cardiff County Court, and I must have cross-examined about 50 or 60 police officers. And I'm in there on my own, and I have over 200 lever arch files. And if I win my appeal, they've finished the evidence, except they're holding back the vital witnesses that I believe are the ringleaders, and therefore I have an appeal now on the 7th of June in the Royal Courts of Justice to try and get those witnesses, ex-police officers, senior police officers, to give evidence.
Now, what's your basic claim for harassment? What was happening?
Well, the case has actually shown very nicely that the troubles came from Guernsey. And for example, in May 1993, I went to my surgery that I just opened in Cardiff on my big BMW motorbike.
Well, this is your veterinary surgery?
Yeah, my veterinary surgery. And a police officer thought a big motorbike like that in Ely, which was only just after the bread riots. You aren't old enough to remember that. And they arrested me because they thought I might have stolen it. Now, they then investigated the fact that I had bought the bike by the registration. They rang Guernsey Police, and they said, oh, yes, that used to be Mr. Farnham's son, the Farnham, the composer. And he was a policeman. I'd bought it off a policeman. And they said, why? And they said, well, we've got to go, Mr. Kirk. He said, Kirk? What? Not Maurice Kirk. And this is all came out in evidence. And they said, what, you've got Maurice Kirk, the vet? He said, oh, he goes to court dressed as Klaus Barbie. He's in full Nazi uniform when he goes to court. And I was immediately continued to be detained that night. They went to court next day and said, we do not know who this man is. And they put me in Cardiff prison.
So is there any truth to this thing of you dressing up as a Nazi? What's that all about?
Oh yes, it's on my website, the local press.
You've got to have a pretty good reason for that.
Oh yes.
What was it?
I'll tell you why. Because I was a veterinary surgeon in Guernsey, and I was the only one on the island when we had a census, which I totally approve of. I was prosecuted for failing to do it properly or something. I forget the technical aspects of it, but it was a nonsense and it was a vendetta. And I was the only Englishman, and of course I had a house full of workers from England, Scotland and Ireland who came over to do the holiday work, and I used to cram them into bedrooms and you know, there'd be four or five and so on. And I think I was off the island on the day, but something went wrong and they prosecuted me. And I was so incensed that I was the only one who'd failed to fill in a census form correctly, I went in Nazi uniform. I was going to go in a bear's uniform as a brown bear, but I couldn't get into the thing in the last.
So you were making reference to the fact that Guernsey was occupied by the Nazis, and really they're taking the mickey.
Yes, but I was getting a lot of harassment by the police anyway, and which is legendary. And
you think that was going to ingratiate you to the authorities, dressing as a Nazi?
Well, I won the court case, and I was on television, interviewed on TV. But the problem is that when they found out that I'd left the island and gone to work in the Vale of Glamorgan, where I actually bought a veterinary practice, they said, hound him. And they sure did.
Well, let's just also go into your background a little bit, because you're an aviator. I think one of the reasons that you are into the whole aviation thing is because it allows you to sort of swoop in and do your vet stuff in farmers' fields and things like that. But you were mentioning to me earlier, which I found quite intriguing, that you actually landed in a polo field once. Now, were there horses and riders actually playing polo at the time?
No, of course not. Of course not. I used to keep my aeroplanes on Taunton Polo Field, actually.
Where is that in Taunton?
Just behind the racecourse.
Righto.
Prince Charles was there one day, and I had a French biplane, an old stomp, and very aerobatic. It's what the Rothmans team used to use back in the 60s. And it was a very aerobatic aeroplane. It was a wonderful beast. And I thought, well, shall I see if he'd like a flip? And I thought, well, hang on a moment. It hasn't got any paperwork. It's in French registration. And it hasn't got an MOT. I don't think I better. And the engine failed the following week at 600 feet. And I landed in a cornfield full of corn, just ready to cut. And, you know, it was the softest landing I've ever done in my life because the wings took the weight on the corn. Now, very few people know these things because very few people have reason to land in standing corn.
Okay, so you were actually using the polo field as a basically a little airfield.
Yes.
And also, you did famously, I mean, you've got one of your little business card here with a little aeroplane on it with the registration G-KIRK, which is your surname, Maurice Kirk. You went to New Zealand. Is that picture actually from New Zealand?
Yes, I was. That was just before I did the world record for a Piper Cub. I flew from Norfolk Island to...
Okay, where's Norfolk Island, though?
Well, I've told you the other half of this story, so I'll tell you the first half. And in order, I was following Sir Francis Chichester's route, because like me, when my eyesight gets any worse, I'm going to be buying a lovely sailing ship and I'm going to sail around the world. And I'll do exactly what he did.
Rather than fly.
Yes.
Now, Chichester was one of the first people to go around the world, wasn't he?
Well, he was the first, but a sailing ship.
Yeah.
Sailing boat. It's named after the aeroplane. I can't remember at the moment. And he was the first to fly a gypsy moth on floats from New Zealand to Australia, and he had to go via Norfolk Island. Norfolk Island was 450 miles due north, but it got you that little bit closer to Queensland. And that picture there is just where I'm hiding fuel in a hedge, because I had to clear customs to go to Norfolk Island 1 hour and a half further south. And in order to get the distance, I had to creep up to the coast, hide at 4 plastic drums, 15 gallons, in a hedge, and then clear customs, and without anybody knowing, quickly land in the field and top up, and then set off for Norfolk Island. Norfolk Island was famous for Nelson's ships. It was the pine trees were the masts in the Royal Navy, and it was a penal colony. And the amusing thing is that I had so many cans, like I described last time, from the New Zealand, from Norfolk Island to Queensland, which I told you that story. But this bit, I got airborne, and I had to siphon the fuel out of the cans in front of me to get into the front little tank, which the D-Day Cub, it was only a 12-gallon tank. And I broke the button off the radio. So I was getting into fog, sea fog, and I was about 100 miles off Norfolk Island.
Can't you just climb above the fog?
No, because I didn't have the instruments to come down. The minute I left sight of the breaking of the waves, I was a dead man. Because if I went up above, because the weather was changing all the time, no, you mustn't. You've got to keep...
But, I mean, if you're down in the fog, surely you could hit a cliff or something.
No, go straight into the side of a... a big ship. That's what I was frightened of, and I have done several times across the world.
So you weren't really
it all blacks out. It all blacks out in front of you, and you know it's not a rock because the rocks aren't there, and you know it's a tanker, and you just simply have to go hard right or hard left. Oh, I know about that. That's happened to me more than once. But
surely you know you've got to have the right instruments in order to fly in those conditions.
Well, I got to Australia virtually without a map. And I got to Australia, I found out that when it was flight tested, just before the air race from New Zealand, from Biggin Hill to Australia, I had a rush job because the chap in California saw my website and he paid for my ticket to go to Australia in the air race. And this 2001 air race, and £25,000. And he said, if you go on it, I'll pay for the ticket. And I got airborne just the day before the race in West Wales, and I found out after I got to Australia that I hadn't been given the airline ticket, the air ticket for the aircraft, and it's the longest test flight for a permit aircraft in Great Britain anybody's ever known. You aren't supposed to leave sight of the airfield while you flight test your aeroplane with the wings on and the instruments in and the new engine on it and the propeller, and you then fill up a form and they send it away, and then you eventually get your MOT. Well, I got a phone call when I was in Australia that I'd flown down there without an MOT. I'm not allowed near. You see, my next one, which is identical aircraft, GKURK, painted exactly the same. This is
silvery.
Liberty yeah. Girl 2, because remember, Liberty Girl 1 finished up at the bottom of the Caribbean. I told you all about that last time. But this one is ready to go nearly, and I'm hoping to set off for South Africa.
Okay, well, that will be an interesting. So this is when your court case is finished, which brings us neatly back to that. So give us a bit of a resume of what's been happening over the last couple of weeks since we've seen
you. This is where there were about 31 incidents where I was found not guilty in courts, ranging from magistrates' courts to appeal courts. And the pattern has clearly come out that I was being harassed.
So basically the police were prosecuting you, but then each time you were showing that there wasn't enough evidence and you were being acquitted. Prosecuted, acquitted, prosecuted, acquitted.
Yes. And there were over 130 alleged offences, and I won 90%. Now, that's by the way, but the important thing that's come out in this case is that the three sets of police officers in South Wales contacted Guernsey because they saw me in Guernsey vehicles, and the evidence came out that the minute they contacted Guernsey, instead of being treated like a local veterinary surgeon with some respect and help whenever I was in trouble with burglaries and so on, the pattern of evidence suddenly changed. It's come out very well. It's very naughty.
Well, I mean, Guernsey is one of these tax havens. I think it's also, I mean, you know, you've made an analogy with the Nazis, and it's actually a little bit like a bit of a totalitarian regime down in the Channel Islands. A lot of people have said that, and also there's this whole world of money laundering, of course, which is a big finger pointing towards the Channel Islands for that. Drug dealing, this kind of
IRA,
thing. IRA,
it used to be an IRA safe house.
Is rife. It's one of those quite, you know, it looks quite nice on the picture postcards, but it's a little bit of an iffy part of Britain. Certainly the tax haven side of it really ought to be closed down. I mean, you know, either make it part of Britain or not. Let's not have a halfway house where people can quietly keep their money away from any chance of it being taxed.
No, there's an argument. I mean, remember, I stood for to be a politician there. I only missed by 32 votes. They should go independent. At the moment, they're making they're a disgrace to the name of the history of England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. I believe they're a disgrace, and they shouldn't be. I don't want them back.
It's a bit like the Falklands. Let's let the people there decide what they want to do. Anyway, getting back to your case, you've also had been amazingly been allowed to
tape
recordings in Cardiff Court.
Yes.
This is almost unprecedented, isn't it?
It is legal precedent, and the case is virtually finished, and all we're doing now on the 7th of June, I go to the Royal Courts of Justice because I am appealing to allow litigants in person, like myself, without any assistance from lawyers, to be allowed to tape record evidence, and for it to be tape recorded under the control of the court. You come in with your tape recorder, you put it with the clerk of the court, and I had applied and got it to tape record the evidence in chief and evidence in cross-examination. And I said, it should be switched off then, because you then might pick up private conversations between barristers and solicitors in the well of the court. And of course, friends of mine have been to prison for tape recording from the gallery. And it needs to be regularised and corrected. Now, there was a complete commotion from the QC, the Queen's Counsel, when the judge said, yes, I'll let you tape record this witness. These were key police officers who were key to the proof that I wanted. And he's now appealed against me to stop me doing it again, and for other people in the country. So the 7th of June hearing in London will be very interesting. And the other reason why I'm in court is, of course, my key witnesses, the chief constable, for example, now retired, was the defendant. And yet I'm not allowed to call her as a witness. She should be giving evidence as a defendant, and I'm being stopped because in jargon, a witness is anybody's property, as you can imagine. And woe betide if you think you've got a friendly witness who then turns hostile. But I said, no, Barbara Wilding was the cause of me being struck off as a veterinary surgeon.
That's your allegation anyway, yeah.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And she...
Well, we'll see. Well, we'll wait for the court to make that decision.
Well, right? No, that's not part of it. I have six more big cases. This is only 31
anyway,
incidents.
Just explain what happened with her.
Well, Judge Nicholas Chambers QC said, yes, yeah, Mr Kirk is upset that each time you have a police incident with him, you aren't disclosing the custody records and the names of police officers at the scene of the traffic incident and so on. And the lady wrote a affidavit on February the 25th, 2009, denying any knowledge of the police with sledgehammer breaking into my surgery, for example, and a court case which involved Guernsey. And it's coming very clear that those two incidents are major items in this case. But when I then got sectioned under the Mental Health Act in June 2009, and then they arrested me for having a machine gun, which I've told you about before.
This is the machine gun that wasn't. This is an old plane, a rusty old machine gun off of a First World War plane that couldn't even fire. Yeah. So, you know, not to alarm listeners. Anyway, Morris, let's get on to looking slightly ahead of things. That's when your case finishes. What is this plan to fly to South Africa? What's that all about?
Well, I still want to get to the Falkland Islands, because when my Liberty
That's
Girl...
South America, not South Africa.
Yeah, I know, but... I'm banned from the United States, so I can't go back and fly across the United States.
What about across the Pacific, the South Pacific somehow?
I was going to do that when I was in Formosa. No, you're too old, too young to know that. I think it's called, what's it called now? Taiwan. And I wanted to go out through Fiji, but the distance between Galapagos and the South America is just too far for this cub. So I've decided to try and go from northern Japan.
To go the other way, basically. Yeah, come across the Pacific.
And the weather was so bad that I turned around and came back to ship it. And that's when the engine stopped and I crashed in Kanazawa City. I've told you that story.
Yeah, but what about South Africa? What's the interest in that?
I want to go down and land on Tabletop. I'm told that a cub can land on Tabletop. A schoolboy.
Table Mountain.
Yeah, Table Mountain, yeah. And then ship the aircraft to the Falklands, because I applied
for
a job there.
That's not like you.
Put
the aircraft in a crate and ship it.
It's 2,000 miles or something. You can't do it. Even I can't do it.
And what's the appeal of the Falklands?
Oh, I applied for a job there when I first qualified. I had a job offered in the Shetland Islands and a job offered in the Falkland Islands, and I love the sea and I love anything to do with boats, and they've got such a history since I qualified in 1968 that I do, and I've got friends there. They keep saying, when are you going to get there? And of course I was on the way there from near Haiti, when the Cub sank 5 years ago.
But the Falklands is right out, it's right down the bottom of South America. It's right out in the middle of nowhere.
It's 450 miles.
What are your thoughts about the whether Britain should still control it? Because a lot of people are saying, well, it's actually really nothing to do with the Falkland Islands. It's actually about the oil deposits which are around in the Atlantic Ocean, around that part of the Falklands. That's what the British government are really interested in.
I think Maggie was well keyed up on that when the lady launched a few ships. Yes.
Let's just hope, anyway, that you can get down to South Africa and get down to the Falklands before the Argentinians nab it.
I'm going to meander because I get lost a lot nowadays, and I'm going to keep the water on the right-hand side. So I'm going to go down, keeping an eye on the sea all the way down the African coast. And then in the middle...
Don't fly into the sea fog, Maurice, please. No. I'm sure we'll definitely have you back. Make sure you come back here before you fly off, and also give us a report on how it all goes in London and the final judgment of your case.
Nice pictures on my website.
Okay, you better just remind us of the website again.
KirkFlyingVet.com.
Okay, Maurice Kirk, thanks ever so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, with the coalition government, there's quite a lot of resistance to cuts, as you might have noticed. Probably the focus for that in Bristol here is the two organisations which are related to each other. One is the Trades Council. That's where delegates from all of the different branches, Bristol branches of the national trade unions, come together once a month, and they do a little bit of organising. The other one is BADACA, which is the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, which is also mostly trade unionist, but a much broader church. And also BADACA tends to be, sort of doing much more in the way of organising. But the big event for the Trades Council, and it's got bigger since the Conservative government came in. Over the years, it's become the May Day. Rallies were rather slack, but certainly after the coalition, they're not anymore. So it's the Trades Council that organised it, and it happened on the Saturday, the 4th of May. So I thought before the end of the month, it'd be a good idea to hear what actually went on. I think probably in another world, you might find the BBC broadcasting some of the speeches from Castle Park on Saturday, the 4th of May, as part of what they call the May Day Rally organised by the Trades Council. So let's go back a couple of weeks to that event and hear from one of the speakers, who I'm not quite sure who was doing the introductions, but she's introduced anyway. And the focus is on the National Health Service.
I think one of the most despicable parts of the government's attack has been the way it's been trying to get rid of the National Health Service. It's been trying to privatise it, and it's an idea of making money out of people's illness, which is literally sick. Somebody who's in the front line of all of this is our next speaker, who's Selena Williams, who's an NHS nurse from Unison.
Hi, my voice is a bit gruff. I've been doing rather a lot of shouting. My name's Selena Williams. I'm a nurse in the Bristol Royal Infirmary, and I've worked for the NHS for 27 years. In the NHS, we are about saving lives, and we don't speak ill of the dead. But there's one death a few weeks ago that brought a smile to my face, and I hope it did to yours. I spoke of it ill of Thatcher when she was alive, and I'm not going to change now she's dead. The brutal class warrior had a private family funeral costing £10 million. But Thatcherism is still alive. Cameron is the grandson of Thatcher. Not the son, we did have Blair in between. But just like Thatcher, who started smashing the NHS by privatising cleaning in the 1980s, the coalition government is in the process of destroying our NHS. For them, illness equals profit, not care, treatment and support, but as a golden opportunity for their rich friends to crawl all over it like rats in a sewer. Despite 170,000 signatures against this health bill, from April the 1st, any qualified provider can bid for NHS money. The starting gun has been fired for selling the NHS, piece by piece. The coalition are forcing private healthcare to become the number one choice for GPs. An excellent, clinically effective system is being undermined by the financial Armageddon of PFI and all the other cuts around us. One look across the Atlantic, you can see the shambles of privatised care, and that's where we're heading if we don't fight. And what some fights we've seen in Edinburgh, in Worcester, in South Yorkshire, in Whittington, Last Saturday in Ealing, 5,000 people marched to save their NHS. In Lewisham, 25,000 people marched to save their accident emergency department. The Tories tried to use the Staffordshire scandal to attack the NHS. When they tried to close that A&E, 30,000 people turned out to defend it. People want to defend the NHS. We can't wait for the next general election to defend the health service. There's no guarantee the Labour Party would win, but there's no guarantee that Labour won't roll back the onslaught. Thousands of people have come out to defend the NHS. It's up to our trade union leadership to coordinate action and organise a fight. If the Labour movement don't start to lead a serious fight to defend the NHS, there are other political forces ready to blame anyone but the rich for the misery. I want to say this for the record. The National Health Service provides a high quality of care with the sacrifice and dedication of staff from all over the world. My real brothers and sisters are the Bangladeshi clothing workers, 400 of whom burned to death for profit. My message is to immigrant workers in Bristol, from Bangladesh, from Poland, from anywhere in the world, you are welcome here. The starting gun has been fired. We have no moment to lose. To defend our NHS, we have to bring together those fights, we have to resist, and we have to unite that resistance. Thanks very much.
And that was Selina Williams, who's a nurse at the Bristol Royal Infirmary, speaking earlier this month at the May Day rally in Castle Park. And maybe we'll have more on from that, because even though there's some quite passionate speeches, the other broadcasters around the city don't seem to want to broadcast it. And obviously, the National Health Service is a national treasure. Now I'm joined by Cristina Dorador. Cristina, hi, you're from Spain. Just remind our audience what you're up to in Bristol.
I'm here in Bristol now, working here and trying to improve my English.
Well, it's a bit of a test now, because you're going to do, well, not exactly a film review. Cannes Film Festival ended last Sunday. The Palme d'Or of this year went to a film about a lesbian romance. Blue is the warmest colour, is it?
Yeah.
It's a French-produced film directed by the French-Tunisian director Abdelatif Kechiche. The movie is about a lesbian relationship, and it was awarded in the middle of the protests in France against the Marriage for All law. This law allows gay couples to get married and adopt children in France. So, Cristina, what's the movie actually about?
This movie is about a gay romance between the young Adele, that is a teenager of 15 years old, and a blue hair color girl. That's the reason, because the name of the movie. Her name is Emma, and Emma will help Adele to discover herself as a woman and as an adult.
Now, the timing is fascinating, isn't it? Because we've got protests across France, actually some violence as well, whether that's by the gendarmes or by the protesters is another question. So what about the timing?
This movie has been awarded in France now. The Marriage for All law is a law that allows gays and adopt children and get married in France, and this law was approved this last month and provoked lots of protests and riots throughout all France. And actually last week 400,000 French people took the street to oppose this new law in France. So it's really special that the jury chose this movie as the winner of the Palme d'Or of this year in Cannes.
Well, it's obviously a big issue in France right now. So what message does giving it the Palme d'Or, which is the creme de la creme film of the year award, really, what does that send to the French people and the French electorate and the politicians?
The president of the jury of this year in Cannes, the director Steven Spielberg, said that the politic was not on the room when they choose this movie, and he says that it was not in the room and the politics didn't take part of this decision. But anyway, the decision of choosing this movie for the Palme d'Or is striking in the current political and socio-cultural context in France.
Do you believe Steven Spielberg when he says that? Because it does seem that they're trying to send a message to the French people and the French politicians.
I don't know, but I think that it's really, it catches your attention that this movie has been chosen in these times because there were lots of very good movies this year, and why they choose this movie instead another one.
Well, it would be interesting if you get the chance to watch it, have a look and tell us if you think it's actually a really good film or not, or whether it's just been chosen for its political impact.
Okay.
All right, Christina Dorador, thanks very much.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
And you're listening to Dialect, the Justice Programme. And joining me on the line now from Scotland is Brian McKerro. Hi, Brian, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, your court case to see your daughter started in around about 2003. Can you tell us what led up to that case?
Well, basically, since I was told that I was going to be a dad, I was literally stymied, even from the pregnancy onwards. No real explanation. It was a cordial, consensual relationship up till then, although it was brief. And then she just called the whole thing off in any contact.
I mean, one would have thought that if you're the natural father, you have some sort of right. So what did you discover back in 2003?
Well, we have absolutely no rights whatsoever. You have to go through an arbitrary process of which you have no control. There's not anything really centred around fathers in that situation. And it's so unnatural to a perceived natural sense of justice, actually, that, you know, you're thrown sideways. But then again, you've just got to put your faith in the process, so one goes along with it.
Well, that's difficult, isn't it? Because you've just said that you found that you couldn't really have that faith. But first of all, did you get yourself a lawyer or not?
Yes, I did.
And how did you find that?
To begin with, it seemed pretty straightforward. We would make our pleadings, what sort of contact we're looking for, what was the reasons. As far as I hadn't had contact to then, even at that point, my solicitor didn't want to discuss it, which was a bit unusual. So I thought that would help to reinstate the fact that it was a fit parent, and then try and make a process towards contact. But we were stymied every stage of the way. It was no, no, no. And my daughter's mother was adamant of that.
I mean, were any reasons given to you about why you had no access to your daughter?
No. At first, it was muted in a letter, and the first correspondence back that I was abusive and unstable. But that would then evaporated to she's got to that now, and that evaporated during the process of even just trying to make contact for very much just child-centred things. We never disrespected her wish to stop the relationship between me and her, but obviously we did try and maintain contact with respect to the daughter. But as I say, there was any desire to have any involvement with us whatsoever.
Well, there may not be any desire, but one would have thought that through any kind of natural justice, through the courts, that you would be granted some sort of access. So what happened after 2003?
Well, I think the whole easily accessible facts of the case speak volumes of that fact you just said, which is the case, because I was denied any access, any parental rights, was given no reasons in terms of a reference to any evidence that had been heard, why that was. Went to an appeal, the same courts, the appeal level, was denied, again with the same sort of synopsis lacking in the decision. Went to the court session, won my case on that basis, went back for a fresh proof, and this all happened over a period of 4 or 5 years, and was recently my case was dismissed.
Well, why is that? I mean, it sounds to me like the one court is saying that you may have a chance, but you're saying that it was dismissed. Why?
Well, they would say, and I'll leave that to the facts. I don't want to get too much into the details of the case at the moment, just in case we do overstep the mark. But suffice to say, as a matter of public record, what I'm saying anyway, but they would say that I dismissed the case. Although that might be the case, I'm not fully competent, and I have been running my own case for now several years with the assistance of other people.
So what was it that made you decide to become a litigant in person? Was it, I mean, we hear a lot about those, the idea of people representing themselves on this programme. Was it a matter of choice, or was it that you ran out of money?
Well, it was a matter of a bit of both, but I would say as one goes on, yes, one realises that spending money with representatives who will certainly give you what is legally competent within the realms of what they think is realistic coming from a sheriff, they actually don't look keenly at questioning that judgments coming down using the law, is the best way I could put it. And one has to actually find a couple of really maverick lawyers and people with law degrees who are not members of the Law Society. And, of course, the biggest experts outside that field are the ones that have been at it through duress, i.e. exactly the parents who have been dragged around courts for years upon years is nothing more than it would seem a cash cow for the legal industry.
Well, I mean, we have many people on here, and often a regular slot from Sabine McNeil at victimsunite.net, which is a website which looks at miscarriages of justice, literally a kind of blog site. How does the and there are often criticisms on there about the family courts being very secretive. What is the situation up in Scotland, Brian? Is it a similar kind of family court system?
I think there has been changes, but they're very slow. And they're in denial about where they are, so as you can imagine, therefore we don't get the right direction. Yes, they're very secretive. One can understand some of the practical reasons for it, but we think that there should still be more recording and more accessibility from certain parties to give assurance that people are now getting due process.
Well, one of the things that's involved in due process, Brian, surely, is if you are being accused of in some way being unfit or unable to have access to your daughter, that you should be given a reason for that. Now, over these, it is 11 years or so now of this case rumbling
on. Sorry to interrupt, Tony. But it is very important to emphasise that actually on this case, it's never been stated, and in fact it's been reinforced, that there's never been a question of my fitness to be a father. And I'm indeed a father since this event. I have been for a long time. And it's never been a question of me being an unfit father. That's what some of the strange aspects of the case.
Okay, how can you be? I'm trying to get to the nub of this, Brian.
Help me,
please. Because if you aren't, then why should you be excluded? And what has been said in previous cases about this?
That's the unfortunate, strange thing. The last competent decision that stands is from a court session higher house within the judicial process, where they have recalled the two interlocutors, the two decisions from the previous two proofs, well, one proof and then an appeal, and they've been removed. And then we've had the new proof, which is now, as I say, stalled at me being dismissed, as they would say, at my behest, because I was not happy with where the sheriff was taking the case. Once again, it seemed
okay
to be a repetition rather than come to where we were going to get to, so I felt I had to remove myself from that court hearing. But it's now been dismissed and I'm looking to take it for judicial review.
Okay. What advice have you got for mothers or fathers that are having trouble getting any kind of sense through the family court system and certainly feel that they should have access to their children but aren't getting it? What advice have you got, Brian?
Well, hopefully, I think it's in the vast majority, even if there is tensions, I hope that they would try and be very, very, very patient with their partner and try and be child-centred. That's the most important thing, I think, for any parent, no matter what the circumstances. Try and work with the other parent, but be well aware of the fact that you do have rights if your name's in the birth certificate now. But it's the last place you want to end up in is a courtroom.
Absolutely right. And also, any advice for organisations that you've found helpful?
Yeah, well, there's a couple that I've worked with closely in Scotland. There's Families Need Fathers, who seem to now be gathering a lot of support, even from the government, although obviously they've not cited the point that we would want to make from other members, which is that there's issues around the legislation itself. We think it's on a par with the idea, for example, of mothers not being paid, women not being paid the same as men for the same job. That was removed because it wasn't compliant with their convention rights or community law because they were being discriminated. And I'm stating that the same statutory principle means it's impossible for Scottish Parliament, at least, to even propose a bill where men are still, and therefore children are still, denied the same inalienable rights to that parent on the basis of that parent's gender. And that's what I've been trying to uncover from many members of the Parliament who seem impossible to show me the documentation. And I think it's a big story waiting to happen. That would put on a par with the expenses scandal.
Crikey. OK, well, Brian McCarrow, Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect today.
Thanks for your time, Tony.
Well, now I'm joined by Paul Fernie on our journey through the solar system. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tony.
Where have we got to?
We've got to the magnificent planet that is Jupiter.
Now, isn't Jupiter one of these ones that's rather nasty to land on, though, if you happen to be a human?
Well, as there's no surface as such per se to talk of, then, yeah, it would be pretty tricky to land on it.
Right. So you can't stand up. That's the first thing. And what are the basics?
Jupiter's fifth planet in the solar system, fifth from the sun. It's the biggest of all the planets, 318 times the mass of the Earth, and 2.5 times the mass of all the other planets in the solar system. It has a diameter of 88,650 miles.
Now, how does that compare to Earth, then?
Earth is just under 8,000 miles in diameter.
So it's 10 times further across than the Earth.
Yeah, about 11 times further. You can fit 11 Earths across its diameter.
Right, it's pretty enormous. But you said just a minute ago that it's got no surface. So how do we know how far it is across? Ha!
Well, it's quite easy. Bit of astronomy, bit of mathematics. Soon work it out.
Well, I'm not sure that that was a... Come on, let's have a better answer than that.
Well, okay.
Is it a rough estimate?
When we look at the diameter of a planet, it's sort of... in the case of gas planets, it's up to the sort of surface cloud level that it's measured in diameter. So it's what we can visibly see.
Planet. You've just given another part of Jupiter away there. How much is it gas, and is there any rock in the middle of it?
It's all gas all the way down. It's there's the cloud cover, which is what we can see, is primarily made up of ammonia crystals, and they're broken into two different cloud decks. The rest, from that was 50 kilometres down, the rest is helium and hydrogen. And this leads us on to, it's sometimes referred to as being a failed star because of all the hydrogen and helium. But it's not actually really appropriate to call it a failed star. It would need to be more than 70 times its current mass in order to ignite fusion and become a star. But they suspect that at the centre, the hydrogen and the helium become a sort of liquid... liquid solid mix, quite a complex chemical structure.
Well, I mean, any gas, if it's under enough pressure, is going to become a solid, isn't it?
It will do, yeah. But it isn't solid all the way. It's not actually solid, Tony. It's really hard to explain.
Okay, so if you were in some sort of little bullet train, which was made of titanium or something extremely hard, right? And could you actually sort of just travel down into the middle of Jupiter and out through the middle to the other side?
No, I mean it's the gas becomes a liquid solid, but it's not actually it doesn't ever become completely solid in the sense of how we understand
solids.
Well,
like a rock or something.
It's not like a rock, no. It becomes this this hybrid liquid solid. It's, like I say, quite difficult to explain. And I'd probably need to do a bit more research on that.
All right, well, okay, so it sounds, yeah, okay, so if it's a liquid, my bullet train might be able to make it through.
Yes, Tony. if you pass the plans on to me, I'll have a look at it.
Further look at it. Okay, but this business of it possibly becoming a star, you think that's definitely a no-no?
Yeah, it hasn't
not
got...
Not enough mass.
Hasn't
not
got
enough.
The mass. Okay. Just simply hasn't got the mass. I mean, it is a big, big object, but it doesn't have the mass to ignite fusion.
What colour is it?
Well, if you look through a telescope, it comes through as reds and sort of pale, creamy, beige cloud banks.
Right, so it's a sort of swirling
mass. Yeah, it's a swirling mass of these clouds. These clouds are broken into bands across Jupiter. And one of the cloud belts contains what's known as the Great Red Spot. This is an object. It basically looks like the eye of a hurricane going round, if people can sort of picture that in their heads.
No, I think I'm sure I remember Patrick Moore pointing this thing out, and it's one of those weird things that just stays. It's like a never-ending storm.
Yeah,
goes round and round on the surface. Now, it's a bit of a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And only one.
It was first observed 350 years ago. A century ago, it measured 24,800 miles across. So again,
it's one big storm.
But it is shrinking, and there has been occurrences of other smaller spots appearing in that same cloud bank, which is just below the sort of Jupiter equator. All this movement in the atmosphere, in the cloud banks, is caused by the fact Jupiter is actually one of the fastest planets in the solar system in terms of how quickly it rotates on its axis. It only takes 10 hours. So you can imagine if you were standing on it, you know, it gets, you sort of, you know.
So they have 2 days for every Earth day,
basically,
roughly.
Yeah. Yeah, the Jupiterians have 2 days for every one of our one days.
All those bullet train travellers.
All those bullet train travellers, Tony.
Well, what about, okay, what about the time it takes to go round the sun, though? How long is a Jupiter year?
Not sure. As far as I'm aware, it is about 10 years.
Okay, so it's but they're both fairly similar, you know, to Earth, at least, you know, within an order of magnitude or so.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the spot, though? Because you say it's been around for whatever it is, 300
years. 350
years
it's been first observed.
And is it known to be a storm?
It's just... All we can sort of say about it is that basically there's obviously convection currents going on like there are in Earth's atmosphere, and these convection currents draw material in and create this swirling mass on in the cloud banks. But really, beyond that, nobody can really say for sure what actually...
It sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? A storm that just carries on forever and doesn't dissipate, and also only the one. Any theories about anything else that might be going on? Is it some kind of strange entity, life type force? It looks like a giant eyeball looking at you, doesn't it?
It does, Tony. It does. But I really don't think there's any great risk of aliens from Jupiter coming to visit us.
And probably not as well to speculate on something.
No.
All we know is it is a storm. It's staying there. It's not going away soon. So someone will have to look at it. What about missions to Jupiter? Obviously not manned. It's probably not the healthiest place to stay.
No, I mean, because of this, the speed that Jupiter actually rotates, it creates a massive magnetic field, which subsequently creates a huge radiation belt around Jupiter, which is very harmful to spacecraft and would be very harmful to any visiting humans.
Bullet trains?
Bullet trains would definitely not pass through that area without some form of protection, of course.
Okay, and how does that relate to the moons? Are they further out from Jupiter? It's got how many?
It's got 63 named satellites.
No way! Is that more than anywhere else in the universe?
That's more than anywhere else
in
the solar system that we're aware of. Most of them are less than 10 kilometres in diameter.
Well, that's hardly a moon.
It's still a satellite. I did actually state satellites. However, Jupiter does lay claim to having the largest satellite in the solar system, which is Ganymede, and that's 3,264 miles in diameter.
Now, is that also the largest moon?
It's the largest satellite, so it's bigger than our moon, it's bigger than any
other
moon.
But when you say satellite, I mean, I know I look stupid, but it makes me think of some kind of, like, space lab going around.
It would probably, Tony, make
Telstar
me think of that.
Telstar or something.
But, no, in astronomical terms, a satellite is another body moving around, is a secondary body moving around the gravitation.
And is Ganymede, is it anywhere near sort of habitable?
No, Ganymede is a pretty barren world. However, these objects, because of the sheer gravitational forces involved with Jupiter, because it's so large, the moons that are closest to within the orbiting around Jupiter, the moons that are closest, Ganymede actually is pulled and twisted by Jupiter's gravitational field, which means that Ganymede is actually still active internally. It still has an active, so it's still molten inside.
Okay, so you've got volcanic activity, you've got lava flows, and goodness knows, so it's not the most pleasant place in the world.
Not the most pleasant place in the world. I personally wouldn't book it as a holiday vacation anytime soon.
All right. Any other interesting satellites, since it's got so many?
Yes, I'm sure there's plenty. Unfortunately, I've only got Ganymede down.
Okay. All right. Well, so... Okay, Paul. You put your hands up there.
I'll ask you an awkward question.
Fair enough. What about next week? Where are we going next week?
We're going to Saturn next week, which is another one of the gas giants. Everything sort of outside of the asteroid belt is a gas planet. We'll come to Pluto in due time because Pluto isn't a planet anymore.
Okay, Paul, and you're very much enjoying our journey to the far outer reaches of the universe, which we will be there probably sooner than we think.
We will.
Cheers, Paul.
Thanks, Tony.
Time for the What's On Guide. Jeff.
Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 31st of May, the Prodigy tribute, Jilted Generation, will be performing with support from Hypercharger, Reconcile and Echo Lounge at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance, and doors open at 7pm. Moving on to Saturday, 1st of June, the Nirvana tribute, Novana, will be performing with support from 101% Pantera and The Vigil at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance, and doors open at 7.30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Ramones. This group formed in 1974 in New York, United States, and split up in 1996. In their career, they have released 14 studio albums, 6 live albums, and numerous singles. This is from the album Acid Eaters, which was released in 1993, and is the song Somebody to Love, which was made popular by Jefferson Airplane. When the truth is found to be lies, and all the doors within you lies, don't you want somebody to love?
I'm not sure that the Ramones do it quite for me what Grace Slick did from Jefferson Airplane, but that was
the Ramones with Somebody to Love from the album Acid Eaters. Keeping with Saturday 1st of June, No Means No will be performing with support from Olanza and Dirty Steve at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Finally, on Sunday, 2nd of June, Meat Puppets will be performing with support from Schnauzer at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £9.50 in advance and doors open at 7.30pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2pm every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Maurice Kirk and Christina Dorador. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
let's swim to the moon. Oh, let's climb through the tide. Penetrate the evening that the city sleeps too high. Let's swim out tonight, love. It's our turn to try. Heart beside the ocean. Sullen and aborted currents breed tiny monsters. True sailing is dead. Awkward instant, and the first animal is jettisoned. Legs furiously pumping their stiff green gallop, and heads bob up. Boy. Delicate, pause, consent. If you nostril agony.